thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
How are you? This is John all the way until 3. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm WGN King John on Twitter and on Facebook.
Lord have mercy.
I'm King John. I'm not actually king yet. I want to be someday. By the way, speaking of King John, how about Jon Snow on Game of Thrones last night? That was a pretty good episode. It was the final episode of the season. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of HBO Game of Thrones talk here, but Jon Snow said something last night that I think the producers knew full well resonated beyond just the Game of Thrones. Jon Snow said something last night, and I thought, oh my God, that is so true, and it was a statement about truth. I'm going to get to that a little later on, Game of Thrones fans. Did you notice that too? Also, have you spent time decoding the Taylor Swift single? So the video is out now. You were able to hear it first and now see it when they debuted it at the VMAs last night. The Taylor Swift... a few of us are going to roundtable this a little later on in this hour. I'll just tip my hand right now. I don't exactly understand Taylor Swift. I know she's beautiful and talented. I just don't know why she's always so angry. And this video, I think, is remarkable. We'll talk about that a little after 2, but or after 1:30. But I think it's easy to fall into the decoding Taylor Swift's new song trap. I think what you should do, rather than worry too much about the anger and the lyrics and what is she really saying, is how does it sound? Isn't that the ultimate judge of a song? We'll review that after 1:30, and hopefully you will too. Your weekend, if it was like mine, was a little mixed, wasn't it? I mean, maybe you were at your kid's soccer game, or maybe you went and saw Lady Gaga or Zac Brown or whatever it was that you did, but in the background were a couple of very troubling things. One was, obviously, the Hurricane Harvey, which hit and then really punished Houston. And I'm sitting there today wondering, why is it that the people weren't able to get out of the way? Doesn't this remind you just a tiny bit of Katrina in that we were able to fly Ryan Burrow into Houston and he's able to report and then he's going to fly back? Remember when Hurricane Katrina went down, Oprah Winfrey set up shop there. She did her show from there. And you said, well, if Oprah can get in and out, then why can't all those poor people? I know the answers to some of those questions, but it's not universal. You would think that even though the government didn't say you have to evacuate, the government didn't even say that there's a voluntary relocation order. What do they call that? Not exodus, anyway. You know, where you get, Steve, what do you call it when everybody's got to leave? Evacuation. There was no evacuation orders from state or local officials, but you could have evacuated on your own if you wanted. There are highways there. You could have gotten on that thing Wednesday or Thursday before the thing hit on Friday. And I'm a little mystified as to, I mean, it's so predictable. You see the hurricane coming, then it's as bad, even worse maybe in terms of rainfall than everybody thought. Now they've got flooding. Nobody knows that Houston floods more than people from Houston. And now there they all are, hoping to be rescued off their roofs. And you think, not everybody has a car, but a lot of you do. What was to keep those people from getting in a car and just driving north and living in maybe unfortunate circumstances, maybe a bad motel, maybe at a campground, maybe at a truck stop, sleeping in your car? But wouldn't all of those be better options than being stuck in Houston? I know there's something wrong with my logic here, but I'm just not sure what it is. That those people don't all have the money to do it is not the only answer. There's something else going on, and I don't know what it is. The mayor of Houston said that it's just as well that people stay put. He rather preferred it because if you put 6.5 million people on the highway, that's a recipe for disaster. If you were trying to get out of the solar eclipse traffic jam in southern Illinois and you were coming up 57 or maybe you skirted over to 55, you know what I'm talking about. And that was just a couple hundred thousand people. Granted, that's just a two-lane highway down there. Four-lane, two in each direction. But they've got bigger, better highways in Houston. But they've got a lot more people. You can just imagine how terrible it would have been if everybody was trying to get out of Houston on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. But they didn't even try. That's the thing that's just a mystery to me. Why don't more people try and get out of Dodge? I think the media was also predictably dramatic about it. Somebody somewhere in Texas said that you should write your name and social security number on your forearm if you're still in the Houston, if you're still in Houston, because ostensibly when your body washes to shore, when they finally find you, wherever they're going to find you, they'll be able to identify you. Well, that's a dire warning, isn't it? That puts it in perspective, but it almost seems to be a little over the top, just a little too dramatic to me. So those were some of my thoughts after watching TV and following the stories this weekend. And I'll just cite the media for one other, I think, failing this week, Steve. And that is, this thing is epic. It's epic. It's a 1,000-year rain. We don't get to use 100-year rains anymore because we have too many of those. So this is the 1,000-year rain. Next year's will be the 10,000-year rain. But some people have dry land. Some people aren't, wading to safety. I wish they would show me some of those neighborhoods. They didn't do a very good job of this with Katrina either. I know where the action is, but I'm trying to get a sense of the thing.
So you want to see the planes landing safely at O'Hare? Is that what you're saying?
Totally. I do. I want to see families who aren't underwater, and I want to see the dividing line. Somebody tweeted, I was looking at CNN today, and they had the 10 most dramatic images of the flooding. And they are, one is just as remarkable and dramatic as another. Like at a mall, an escalator going down into a pool of water. You just go maybe two steps in, and then it's just underwater. It's horrific looking. But I'd like to see them show me some dry land. One of the images of these 10 was a map of the metro. Houston is kind of a square-shaped city. And then you have the, 294s that kind of go around the city, and then the major thoroughfares and highways inside. Some of them on this, most of the roads on this image are blue. And it says all of the blue roads are underwater. You get the sense that virtually every highway in Houston, every major thoroughfare is underwater. But there has to be some dry places and people. If 30,000 people are evacuated in a city of 6.5 million people, then show me some of the 6 million people, just so I get some perspective. That's all I'm asking for. I'm not saying those people aren't suffering. It's not a crisis, and they don't have their hands full. I'm just trying to understand the gravity or the scope of the thing, and CNN is doing a terrible job. Instead, they keep showing that swirling, multicolored map, and they're all getting very dramatic and saying, write your name and social security number on your forearm.
Well, if I can speak up for my brothers and sisters.
I'm going to talk to Ryan Burrow, and he's going to be thoroughly dramatic in a minute, and that's because he's going to be in the middle of it, and that's what we ask him to do. But I think we should ask these people to tell us about the dry places as well.
I would say probably that moving around is pretty difficult. Resources, people there are probably fairly limited, and it's only natural that you go to the most dramatic scenes.
Right. Right. Yeah, I know. I mean, if Ryan said, well, John, I'm at a mall outside of Houston, and it seems to be fine. Back to you.
But you want to know the percentage of normal.
I do.
And I understand that. That makes sense. And it might come, after
eventually
a few days.
Yeah. I mean, Ryan was able to get there. And he's going to come back on a regularly scheduled flight.
Not for a while, right? The airport's closed still for a while, I think.
Does he know that? Because he got in somehow.
He flew in. He left at 6 o'clock on Friday night.
Did he?
Yeah.
I wonder, did he fly into Dallas, or did he fly into Houston?
I think he flew into Houston when I was leaving here. He was getting ready, so.
Yeah. We'll ask him some of those questions as well. The other interesting way to follow this, of course, was through the president's filter. Donald Trump's Twitter account was remarkable in a number of ways this weekend. Rex Hupke at the Tribune pointed out that the president has tweeted, I think it was 10 times today, Hupke said, and not once did he offer any information about how you can get or give help. It was more, Donald Trump loves to be the first to stand up in class and say, oh, I know. So he'll say, wow, this is a 500-year flood. People are saying they've never seen anything like this. That'd be a typical Trump tweet. Meanwhile, Barack Obama simply tweeted, thank you to all of the first responders and people helping each other out. That's what we do as Americans. here's one way you can help now. And then there was a link to the American Red Cross. That got 602,000 likes. I mean, Donald Trump's account is mammoth, and his retweets, likes, and comments are the things of legend. President Obama's simple statement and a link to help blew anything Trump did over the weekend out of the water. There's no sense in keeping score here, right? I mean, that's not what it's about, but we kind of do. And you know the president does as well. And there Barack Obama's just laying in the weeds, and then he says, oh, I'll do it. Hey, everybody, you know, thank you for helping each other out. Here's how you can participate with the Red Cross. And that got 602,000 likes and many tens or hundreds of thousands of retweets. I don't know that that bothers President Trump or not, but you know he's always mentioning him. In fact, he mentioned Barack Obama in a tweet today. Today he did. You may have an observation, a question, or a comment. Incidentally, we said on Facebook, and we didn't get a big response on this, if you have family or friends in Houston and can tell us how they're doing, we'd love to hear their story. If you have friends or family in Houston and you can tell us how they're doing, we'd love to hear about that. From 630, if people evacuated from Houston before Harvey hit, they could have gone to even less safe areas. Maybe so. John Bobby Jindal in New Orleans was telling their people, if you are not going to evacuate for Hurricane Katrina, write your Social Security number on your arm. Jindal did that too, huh? John, my cousin who lives in Spring, Texas, is fine. He's got power, the stores are open, etc. She's a half hour north of Houston. South, of course, it's raining like all hell there. But a half hour north, she can go to the store. It's 119. This is WGN. I was at a Whole Foods store yesterday, and the woman in front of me had six things, and all of them were 2-liter bottles of sweetened soda. And I thought, oh, you poor thing. I almost started a GoFundMe page for her right there. She had six 2-liter bottles. I thought, oh, my God, this is the most inefficient purchase in Cook County of the day, because there was nothing else on the little ramp there for her but that. It was the only thing she was buying was soda. And I thought, oh, my God, you yourself are about to fund a wing of the Cook County Hospital. Thank you. I should have said thank you, if nothing else. A little night baseball on WGN-TV. The Cubs welcome the Pirates for a Central Division showdown tonight at 7 on WGN-TV Sports. I'll bet you know someone who's getting older and wants to stay in their home. And I'll bet you're concerned about that person's safety. It might be you. One in three Americans over the age of 65 will fall this year. I'd like to introduce you to the folks at Remodel Direct. Remodel Direct. They do one thing. They specialize in making homes safer and more comfortable to age in. Remodel Direct is a Chicago company. They serve all of Chicagoland. They are certified living in space specialists. That's a thing. They walked through my parents' home with me, my mom, and my dad about a week ago. And I said, well, let's just see how you guys do what you do. Come out to my folks' house. My dad's going to be 90 soon. They're that age. But they're still living in their home. God bless them, and how lucky for me. And I got to tell you, it is amazing what a set of fresh eyes can see. Mom was using a step stool in the kitchen. I didn't realize, but they noticed it. And that's dangerous for her. Now easy pull-down shelves will make that safer and easier. Imagine that for you or someone you know. Pull-down shelves. You reach up and the shelf actually pulls down. You get the salt or pepper out, and then you just gently lift it back up into place. You don't have to get up there. They do walk-in tubs, tub-to-shower conversions, safety grab bar, stair lifts. Remodel Direct specialists are very understanding, and they have factory direct pricing. Remodel Direct will bring their showroom to you. Remodel Direct, your home, your independence, their passion. Call 888-70-DIRECT. Call this number right now if you know someone, if you are someone who could use somebody to come in and make your house safer and more efficient. 888-70-DIRECT, 888-70-DIRECT. Direct. It's 124 on WGN. Let's see here. Some texts. And is that Marcy? Marcy, this is John. You're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm great. Thanks.
What's on your mind?
My sister and brother-in-law live northeast of the city, about 20 minutes in Kingwood. They have gotten rain, and they've got some rain in their yard, but other than that, they don't. They're good. However, The last hurricane, they did go to evacuate, and they were going to our brothers in Dallas, which is usually a four-hour drive. It took them 10 hours.
Yeah.
So if more people evacuated for this one, I mean, you couldn't go anywhere. And like they said on, you know, on TV, they'd run out of gas. So
that'd be a disaster. And, you know, listen, I'm not saying this is easy. And and while I'm questioning why more people don't get out of Dodge, I know I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to the specific details of it. We had a reporter on last week, and he said some people get in their pickup trucks there in Texas. They try and outrun a flood or a hurricane, and they end up getting washed into a ravine. You know, people drown. 1,800
Absolutely.
People lost their lives in Katrina, for crying out loud. So they're doing okay, though?
They're doing fine. They've got power. Again, they do have some water in the yard each day, but that drains off. And
well, are they getting they must be getting the same constant rain, though, right?
They're getting a lot of rain, but it looks like it's kind of hooking away from them. I mean, they do have some torrential rain downpours, but not like you see in the city downtown and
No kidding. Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I appreciate your thoughts on this, Marcy. Thanks for the phone call.
You bet. Thank you, John.
You betcha. There was, you know, what some people are doing is they're going on Facebook Live or are posting videos for their family and friends, because if you had family or friends in Houston, you would type to them and say, hey, how you doing? We're worried about you. A nice way for everybody, instead of responding to each, is to simply post a video. A woman named Blair Johnson, who is from, is this the female or the male? We saw the husband and the wife. So Blair is the wife, and they posted a video. And I think they have roots in Chicago. Hey, Blair, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you today?
Good. So you are in Houston, right?
We are in Houston, yes, in the midst of all of this.
What's your connection to Chicago?
My husband is originally from Rockford, Illinois, and we lived in Chicago up near Wrigleyville for 6 winters.
Not 6 years, 6 winters. That's how,
yes,
that's how you put it.
I'm a Southern girl. I'm originally from Atlanta, so I counted the winters.
How are you? I saw your video, and you are one of those families that appears to be fortunate enough to not be underwater right now.
Right now, we are not. That video, if it's the one I'm thinking of, was from Saturday, and boy, a lot has changed since then. We have been extremely blessed and lucky to be in an area that is not experiencing the significant flooding like you see from the news reports, but they are releasing water from the reservoirs, which are a little northwest of us, and that could change in an instant because they're trying to do a controlled release of the water to reduce some of the pressure. And if that happens, you know, because there's just no place for the water to go now, and all the bayous are full, and by controlling it, they're hoping to avoid a lot more damage than could be if it breaks.
What's been the most dramatic observation or troubling observation, this notwithstanding? What's surprising you down there?
The very slow moving storm, how it has come in off the Gulf, turned back onto itself, and just won't leave. It's stuck. It's kind of in this circle and hitting us, about to make landfall, I think, for the third time.
Yeah.
This is unprecedented. When they say it is unprecedented, it is. Just to give a reference, when Hurricane Ike came through, which was actually a lot more of a direct hit for Houston, it came in and was on its way to Arkansas within 36 hours. So for us to still be under all of this torrential downpour for days that's what's the most unusual thing.
I saw a meteorologist on TV today describe those arms of the hurricane as almost if they were, you know, arms with buckets, and they go out to the coast, get the Gulf, get more water, and then just keep dumping it on you guys.
That is a good explanation, yes. That seems like what's been happening. We have had a few breaks with a few bands in between the rainstorms here, which has allowed a little bit of draining, but not enough, because we are just continuing to get the rain. I saw a report this morning that George Bush International Airport has gotten 25.65 inches of rain, and they're expecting 12 to 18 inches more, and average rainfall in Houston is about 49 plus inches a year, and they're saying we could reach that number in a week.
Blair, before you came on with us, I was just wondering out loud why more people didn't get out of the Houston area. What's your answer to that?
That is a good question. We were not under any protocol to evacuate. There was a lot of debate between, I believe, the governor and the mayor. But no, I don't think anybody could have predicted this. And we do have evacuation protocols in effect here in the Houston area, but did not get the call. We are now certain areas of the city. And just to put that in perspective, Houston is a huge, huge city. It is actually larger than the island of Oahu. So there are certain areas that are now being evacuated, and we were told through the beginning, you know, stay in place.
Yeah.
And until you hear the call to evacuate, stay in place. So that is what I believe most of us have done.
Claire, if you wanted to, could you get in your car and drive away? I mean, I presume as long as you're not going south, the highways are open. They're traversable, right?
Some are and some aren't. We would not be able to know that until we got out onto the roads to see which way to go. And that is, I think, the other part is that if we were to get an evacuation call, we're not sure which direction to go
and
which roads would be open at this time.
You know, we run into that in Chicago, and you know that from your time here. When it rains hard, and by that I mean 2 inches, 2 inches in Chicago.
Yes.
Parts of our major thoroughfares get flooded just in low-lying areas, but you only need one area to be flooded, then the whole road is shut down.
That is correct, yeah. Similar here as well. And we do know the locations in our city that flood. We've experienced flooding before from other tropical storms and heavy rainfall, et cetera, and you just never know because we're flat. We are a very flat city, so it's hard to predict where the rain will flow.
Blair, will you join us again tomorrow? I'll let you go today. You've got more to do than talk on the radio, but let's connect about this time tomorrow. I'll make a little more time for you. And is there anything that I or our listeners can do to help you all out?
Well, thank you for asking. We are probably going to need a lot of supplies because there's going to be a lot of families that have been displaced. And I know that they've been putting the call out for baby food and diapers. But at this point, there's no real easy way to get the supplies.
Right, right.
So I will research that some more and have an answer for you for that.
Let's plan on visiting tomorrow. I think that'd be helpful to you and helpful to us as well, okay?
Great. Thank you so much.
Your old neighbor, Julie Stern, I work with her. She says hi.
Well, tell her hello. She's one of my favorite people. We used to work together, so...
Well, it's nice to hear your voice, I'm sure she's saying, and I appreciate meeting. It's nice to meet you, and let's talk again tomorrow.
Great. Thank you so much.
Her name is Blair Johnson. Hey, Ryan, it's John. You're on the air. Are you there?
Yes, I can hear you, John, and I am at one of these evacuation centers right now that they've got in Houston. They're dropping people off literally by the truckload. They're filling up dump trucks with people who are seeking shelter, and they're driving them here. Dump trucks are obviously open-aired in their flatbed area, and it is pouring outside. So these people are coming in soaked, but it's a feeling they've had for the last few days. The rain has just not stopped, and it continues to fall here. We could see another, maybe foot or so before the end of the week.
Are you in Houston, or are you outside of the city?
No, we are in Houston. I'm in downtown Houston right now at the George R. Brown Convention Center, one of the staging parts for this for the Red Cross, for one of their shelters, their largest one. They've got a lot of facilities available for people here, a lot of nurses and doctors available, staff available. In fact, they just wheeled someone out and took them via ambulance, which is apparently something that they needed. They've got some entertainment they're trying to provide for kids and information for people about their housing and moving forward. And, you know, this is probably the second day of what could be many, many days for these people here.
I saw a story this morning, Ryan, and they showed a gated community somewhere in the Houston area. And so presumably some senior citizens living in there, maybe just rich people, but it was a gated community of some description. And they said they were waiting for a semi-tractor trailer to come, and then they would all get in the back of this semi, and the semi would drive them all out. And then there was trouble getting the semi. And I thought, how strange that the evacuation procedures now are relying on semis there, or in your case, dump trucks. Are the people happy to have that, or are they upset that it seems to be so ad hoc?
Well, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is they're not going to get picked up in Ubers. They're not going to get picked up in taxis. This is how you move people who are desperate to find shelter immediately. You find the thing that can hold the most amount, and they are using buses as well. But essentially, you've got people evacuated from their homes, and they try to find a spot where one of these trucks will swing by and pick them up. There are some locations in which they can go, but people have to walk, you know, 2 to 3 miles sometimes to get to these locations. And I mentioned it was raining this whole time. So it is a challenge because you don't exactly know which roads are flooded out and which ones aren't.
Are people sleeping and eating there, or is this just a staging area before they send them somewhere else?
No, food is here, water is here. I'm looking, they've got a donation center I'm staring at right now, and there are just thousands upon thousands of pillows and blankets and shirts and clothes and bottles of water they're sifting through right now to give to these people. Some of the people who are arriving here aren't actually evacuees. They're people who want to make donations. And so they've been greatly accepting all of these donations, although the Red Cross says they are able to handle probably about 20,000 people if they need to. This shelter probably will only flex to about 5,000 people. And earlier today we had 2,500. It's probably pretty close to 4,000, I would think, by this point.
I'm going to let you go, Ryan, but how long are you going to be down there?
Well, I got to tell you, Friday probably, because for two reasons. Number one, this story just continues to unfold, and the rain probably won't stop till late week. And number two, there are no flights to get out. So, you know, for those people who are here, it is very, very challenging and difficult to get out because the airports, essentially both of them, Hobby and Bush, are shut down.
I've appreciated your reports today, and we'll listen for more, and we'll touch bases with you again tomorrow as well. My best to you and everybody down there, Ryan.
Sounds good. Take care.
This is the new Taylor Swift song. You'll never guess what the title of it is. You just made me do. Want to talk a little bit about this. It's not just that it's a new Taylor Swift song and she's been away for a few years, but it seems to be almost a rebranding of Taylor Swift as well, or is it? So a couple of folks whose names and voices you probably know are going to talk with me about this. One is Michael Heidemann of Sound Sessions, a music podcast we produce here at WGN Radio. You can hear it at WGN Plus. Michael does a sound podcast with Kevin Richter, who you know from the Bill and Wendy show, but these are a couple of guys who know their music real well, and Michael's in our studio. How are you?
Hey, John, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on the show.
You, I was describing some of Kevin's credentials. Kevin Richter, he produces for Bill and Wendy. You produce for Patty Vasquez.
Yes.
And obviously are part of Sound Sessions. Elif Garris, my producer, is also a music reviewer for ThirdCoastReview.com. Is that me? No, that's Elif. That's somebody calling in. She's a producer, and she's wearing two hats right now. What did you make of the song? What did you make of the video?
You know, John, I never realized Taylor Swift had so much beef with so many artists before this music video came out. I was having trouble, like, going through the webs of squashed beefs that she's portraying in this music video.
To me, there's two ways to review this. One is decoding it.
Mm-hmm.
Who is she saying what to whom? I mean, like, really, what's her message? And the other one is, how do you like the song?
Yeah.
Like, what if you aren't Kim Kardashian? Just what do you think about it? Do that part first. What do you think of the song just as a piece of pop art?
Well, straight from the get-go, I was not a fan of it. But this is the same thing that I was telling myself when I got really into Shake It Off a few years ago, her other single.
With the same writing team, too.
Same writing team. I mean, they're doing good things, but it's interesting to think that we have to actually go back and think, oh, do I actually like the song, or am I just enjoying the music video and the fanfare behind it?
Yeah, but when you first heard Shake It Off, that's fun.
Yeah.
Player's gonna shake it off, shake it. That's a fun song.
Absolutely.
This one is harder and darker, isn't it? It's angrier.
Yeah, and even the persona of the music video itself is very dark. People were saying it's Taylor Swift going goth, and it's this whole new web of her persona that's really just showing through.
It has a Madonna, Janet Jackson kind of anti-Kanye. I don't know exactly how to describe it.
Exactly. And it's funny you mentioned that, because when I was watching the music video, I saw the connection to Madonna as well, with the black lace and
yes,
everything. Even standing on top of that big mountain of people, which I thought was her standing in front of a cross, but it ended up being a big T. Which...
I noticed that. I thought, oh, really? That would have been more Madonna-ish, too, if she had done that. And I noticed that it was a T rather than a cross.
Yeah.
So she's not going there. Ella,
not at all.
Did you like the song? Do you just like the... And the video, but I mean, forget about decoding it. Do you like the sound or the view of the thing?
I don't like the song. It's not poetic at all, I don't think. I mean, you heard it just now. She just repeats herself.
Yeah, if while that was a short clip, the song really doesn't deter much from that. I mean, it's got more lyrics. She's talking about, she's angry at people, and she mentions them by code. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't deviate from that sound very much. What, Ella?
You asked who do you think she's addressing in that song, and I think part of it is her fans. Part of it is the people who judge her, especially the most judgmental fans, I mean, and people like Kanye, people like
Katy Perry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, to me, the whole thing is she's talking to Katy and Kanye, and she's telling her fans, I'm not going to, I don't know what, like, what you made me do. What you made me do is change my image. What you made
right,
me do was
exactly.
die and resurrect as this new character. I mean, is that what we made her do? Is that, I don't even know what she's saying.
It has to be, yeah. What did we make her do? We didn't make her do anything. She's doing this purely for the marketing scheme. If you think about it, I looked back because I wanted to do a little research before the show. She deleted all of her old Instagram posts.
Right.
This is a whole new, Taylor Swift that's coming out. And I thought the last Taylor Swift was the new one, you know, the poppier one who strayed away from country music, and now she's becoming this kind of an eviler, more mature Taylor Swift. I don't know what to gather from this music video.
It's villain versus victim, isn't it? I mean, she's playing the victim card. Look at these people. They've said unkind things about me. I'm angry at them. But now she's the villain. She's aggressive and she's calling out names.
Can we think of any other artists that have had this chance to be not only the victim but the villain as well, and kind of like she's kind of creating this whole world around herself, and no one is allowed to escape, obviously.
I don't understand the whole victim card for her anyway. She's 6 foot tall, beautiful, blonde, talented, rich. She does well on, when's the last time? The trial. She was so great on The Stand. She's so great with her fans. She's got A-list celebrities that used to come up on stage with her. There's what's wrong with being Taylor Swift? Except some boys dissed her when she was younger, I guess. God, you don't want to be on that list. Mm-mm. And this fallout with Kanye West and Kim Kardashian about his use of her and whether or not she gave permission to reference her in a song of his. This seems to be predicated on that little diss or big diss.
A lot more legal lawsuits have hit her in the past year after coming out with that explosive album that she put out, the Red Album, and then the next album after that. And now I think that she's trying to get the reins almost from this wild horse that's taking off with the Kanye. She's releasing the album on the death of Kanye West's mom, anniversary of it.
I hope that's a coincidence.
Same here. Unless that team is so nefarious behind Taylor Swift that they can't be.
Don't be that. By the way, Elif, can you play for us the clip where she's on the phone? And I know I played a little of that on my Saturday show. Can you cue it up to that?
I don't trust nobody and nobody trusts me.
Okay, so Taylor's dead.
She wants to get rid of that old persona.
The whole thing, by the way, the video starts with what looks like an homage to Michael Jackson's Thriller.
That's
the whole
a good
graveyard
point.
Scene, you know, and the bunch of dancers kind of doing a monster dance. And then it segues to a glamorous version of her. Lord knows she can look sexy and beautiful, and she does in this. But I'm still not exactly sure, having only heard one song, what she intends to do with her sound now.
What is going to come from this? I mean, it's a lot more 808 kind of sounds. So you can hear that heavy...
club sound.
Yeah, the clubby kind of sound. Obviously playing towards the younger EDM kind of listeners who are going to buy that album. It's funny you mentioned the zombie beginning, because that was a really, really... another strong point, another hidden gem was found in there. She had been writing songs with Calvin Harris, and who she was dating for a while, and the name she used, the the fake name that she used to write these songs.
Oh, yeah, Bjorn somebody or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, Nils Sabjunk or yeah, something right. like that. And that was that gravestone was floating in the background as she was climbing out of that grave. So she's making no attempts to hide what she's doing here.
Okay, so she's settling some scores.
Yeah.
And maybe the video. You know, I was talking to Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It.
Yeah.
Lou has an opinion about everything. I love this guy. He said, I hope I'm not misquoting you here, Lou, but he said, at least she's taking chances, right? I mean, this is what artists do.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a bust, you got to admit, it's a well-produced video, right?
Yes.
I mean, the imagery is amazing. The cutaways, it's a very fast-paced, and there's a lot of backstory to it. They didn't just throw this together.
Mm-mm.
I think that's the problem, though. She focused too much on the cinematography of it and not of the actual art. She's a musician. She's not a videographer or an actress.
You get the feeling a lot of people could have made this song. This doesn't sound like Taylor Swift, unless this is the new Taylor Swift.
They could have just grabbed any great professional music video maker
and got a vocalist to do this song. So then at the very end, and we're going to run out of time, maybe we can play it later, but she has a conversation with various incarnations of herself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's Taylor Swift as all of her various versions, country, pop, sexy, and they're arguing with each other about who Taylor Swift is.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, Taylor Swift, I think the person Taylor Swift says, I'd like to recuse myself from this narrative. She doesn't want to be part of this thing, which is weird because it's her creation.
Mm-hmm.
This is her, we weren't saying this. This is her narrative. And at the end, she says, I don't even want to be part of this story. And then the video ends.
And then it ends on what another chapter of Taylor Swift's, you know, starting up her machine before she gets on this next big tour and makes it really happen. And it's funny that she doesn't want to recluse herself from this narrative, but yet she's premiering the music video at the MTV Movie Awards or Music Awards,
yeah,
which is where she got all this fame from, to be honest.
We watched it with a room full of people last night, and everybody just went, what?
Well, John, what did you think of the song?
What? Michael, I'm out of time. Michael Heidemann of Sound Sessions. If we want to hear your podcast with Kevin Richter, how do we do that?
You can find it on WGNRadio.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, or you can just find it on the WGN Radio app.
Sound Sessions. Elif, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Some sports.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
I need to be quiet while the man is talking. Hey, it's John. Some sports to recap in this hour, including the big fight that was a better fight than most folks thought it was going to be. Sam Panionovich, talk to me about that in the next half hour. In this half hour, the story everybody would be talking about if it wasn't for the hurricane and now tropical storm that everybody's talking about, the 1,000-year rain in Houston, maybe 50 inches, maybe in a week's time what they would get in a year, the 1,000-year rain of Houston. So that has sort of gotten in the way of what would have otherwise been a vigorous conversation about what the president was also talking about over the weekend, and that is his pardoning of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. In the New York Times, Adam Liptak wrote yesterday, or maybe this was in Saturday's paper, President Trump's decision to pardon Joe Arpaio was characteristically unconventional, but it was almost certainly lawful. The Constitution gives presidents extremely broad power to grant pardons. Last month, a federal judge found Arpaio, a former Arizona sheriff, guilty of criminal contempt for defying a court order to stop detaining immigrants based solely on this suspicion that they were in the country illegally. Mr. Arpaio had faced a sentence of up to 6 months in jail. Famously, you know, the president, even before he was sentenced, has pardoned him. Mr. Trump, the New York Times writes, thus used his constitutional power to block a federal judge's effort to enforce the Constitution. Legal experts said they found this to be the most troubling aspect of the pardon. The clause in question says that the president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So the president can pardon anybody who's charged or found guilty of a federal crime, as long as it's not that of impeachment. I guess that makes sense. The pardon powers extend only to federal crimes. The Supreme Court put it in an 1886 decision by saying the power is unlimited. Regardless of what you or I think about it, the Constitution, the courts have said that that constitutional power is, quote unquote, unlimited. It extends, the court said, to every offense known to the law. In an opinion article in the New York Times on Thursday, Martin Reddish, a law professor at Northwestern University, said courts should create a novel exception to the president's otherwise unlimited pardon power. And what Reddish said in this piece, and he's going to join us here in a second, but I'll just paraphrase it. He said, look, the Constitution grants us all due process. Due process. The Constitution also grants the president the power of pardon. If these two constitutional privileges or rights conflict with each other, then which one wins? And he said due process should win. He said if a particular exercise of the pardon power leads to a violation of due process, the pardon power must be construed to prevent such a violation. Okay, so what does that mean, Professor? This is John, and you're on WGN. Thank you, Professor. How are you today?
Oh, my pleasure, John. I'm doing fine. Thanks.
So do you think that the president should not have been able to pardon Joe Arpaio?
I don't think he was able to pardon Joe Arpaio. I think it was a lawless act. This particular issue has never arisen before. I have been writing about constitutional law for 44 years. I had never even thought of this issue because no president has ever weaponized the pardon power the way President Trump has here. We have to understand that the Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, amend. They limit what's in the body of the Constitution. They are the protection of our individual rights. They are the only thing that protects us against tyranny by those in political power. And the only way they can be enforced is through the courts. The courts are the mechanism by which the Bill of Rights protects us. And the weapon that the courts use is the injunction.
Right.
An injunction is an order which tells someone stop doing that or else. And the or else is a criminal punishment for contempt. And that comes in the form of a fine or imprisonment or some combination of the two. What the president's actually done here is immunize government officers from a punishment for violating or ignoring a court injunction designed to protect our individual rights. If the court's power to issue those injunctions is undermined in this way, there's nothing left. There's nothing left of the Bill of Rights. It becomes a meaningless shell. Nobody has really seen it that way. Everybody has seen this as, well, the pardon power is very broad. And yes, on the face of Article 2 of the Constitution, the pardon power is very broad. But anything in the body of the Constitution that is inconsistent with something in the amendments is unambiguously superseded by the amendment. And the Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause in particular appears in one of the amendments. And the president has used the pardon power to circumvent that constitutional protection.
I think a lot of us are wondering if the power of the pardon is such a good idea anyway. When President Clinton pardoned Rich, I think a lot of people thought that just smacked of cronyism and was an inappropriate use of it. But what are you going to do? When Barack Obama, you know, and they all do it on the way out the door. And
right.
It usually seems to be well-heeled, famous people, and money is somehow involved. And it doesn't seem like it's, I don't know, such a swell idea the way it's executed most of the time anyway.
What the framers were doing was starting from the premise that they trusted nobody. And they were trying to juggle all sorts of checks and balances so that everybody could check everybody else. And what they tried to do in the pardon power was give the president some sort of safety valve in case there was an injustice by the judicial system. The president could have the last say of a political safety net, a political fallback. Yeah. It sometimes hasn't worked out very well, but you can't blame them for trying.
Well, do you agree with this, though, that if we don't like what a president is doing, or who he's pardoning, we need to allow him the right to do that? We should not turn every decision into a political football. You know, the president has the power that the president has, and we shouldn't have this argument every single time. Do you agree with that?
Well, what I'm trying to do is prevent it from being a political football, make it a constitutional directive. We live in a democracy, but we also live in a constitutional democracy. A lot of decisions are made by those elected who are accountable and representative of the public. But the Constitution is a limit on those powers.
I get that. But my question to you is, because are we having a conversation because he did something we don't like, or are we having this conversation because we think he actually didn't have the right to do what he did?
Well, that's a great question. I think we should recognize this shouldn't be viewed as a right-left, liberal-conservative thing. Heaven knows I've taken constitutional positions that are very unpopular with the left. This should transcend the debate between left and right. It shouldn't matter who this president is. You think right now the liberals are wrapping themselves in states' rights to protect themselves against the Trump administration. Yet in past years, it's been the liberals who've been critical of states' rights. So you can't think of it on a narrow political level. You have to think of it as a matter of broader constitutional structure.
Well, as a
and this isn't whether it's a good or bad pardon. This is a pardon that takes away the power of the courts to protect our rights.
Yeah. Well, as a political football, though, here's what's happening, right? He's pardoning Arpaio as a signal to anybody who may be called to testify against him in the Russian investigation. And he's saying that if in defense of me to the investigators, you lie or somehow break the law, don't worry, I will pardon you. So if you'll go to bat for me, I'll go to bat for you. Do you see that this is a signal along those lines? Anything to that?
You know, that would be beyond my expertise.
Oh, that's within my expertise, Professor. That's exactly what's happening here.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. But under my theory, those pardons, while very controversial, would be perfectly constitutionally valid. That would be for the political process.
Think about
because
that.
Because that's not being used to take away the courts as a protector of individual rights. That's my most serious concern.
And your concern, although I'm interested in the conversation I just started there, maybe I won't have that with you right now, but I think Donald Trump is saying to anybody who might be asked to testify against him, don't worry, I will use the pardon power, not on my way out the door, but right now, and if you do something that is patently wrong, that's okay, I will protect you. It's still asking, say, a Jared Kushner to do something remarkable, and that is lie to investigators to protect your father-in-law or your boss if it's about, say, Bannon or somebody like that, or ex-boss. But you could at least see the mechanism would be in place. He could do that, right? He could do that, correct?
Yes, he could, and it's a sad situation that we've gotten to the point where we're even thinking about that as a possibility.
But to be clear, your point isn't that. If I understand, then, we have the Constitution that protects our rights, that defines our rights. The courts are there to exercise that, to make sure that we are protected. And when they told Sheriff Arpaio, you can't do that anymore, and he does it anyway, he's in violation of the law. He may have to go to jail for 6 months. The president steps in and says, I'm going to, even before he is sentenced, pardon him. And the upshot of that is what again then? How is that a constitutional issue?
The message I see being sent is not necessarily to the Russian case witnesses. It's to other sheriffs. It's to Sheriff Clark in Milwaukee. Do anything you want. And you can ignore any restraining orders by federal courts because I'm just going to pardon you. Arrest anybody you want. Intimidate anybody you want. And don't worry about what the courts are going to do to you. That's the message I'm concerned about.
Yeah. Do you have another minute, Professor?
Sure.
We'll pause here. Maybe you've got a question, comment, or observation, too. But our pile, the president said at that Phoenix rally, he'll be okay. He'll be okay. A lot of us thought what he meant by that is, let's wait and see what the sentencing is. If he's not sentenced to a long sentence or sentenced to go to jail at all, then a pardon isn't even necessary, or at least not that necessary. But the president preemptively struck. Let's take a call or two then for you. Let's start with Larry. Larry, this is John. You're on the air. What's your question?
My comment is that the president's power is analogous to the power of a jury to nullify conviction of a criminal, even though he's obviously obviously guilty. The juries can set somebody free if they feel that the law is being improperly applied, or if they need. They don't even like the law. So it's built into the system.
So do you think, what's your take then, Larry, on the president?
I think the president should have it, just like juries have it.
I'm asking you about this particular exercise of it.
I'm ambiguous on this one, but I guess I go with the president on it.
Yeah, okay. Professor, any comment on that?
Juries aren't exactly the same thing as the president. The juries are a check by the people on the process. The president is the one with all the power. I think we need to be much more careful with the one that has all the power than just the common person coming to mm-hmm. give their views.
What about Melissa? You're on WGN. Melissa, what can we do for you?
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask the professor. It's my understanding that if they accept a pardon, that they're no longer allowed to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights.
Right.
And they still have to testify. And so as far as it goes to Russia and things like that, for the people who are related to that inquiry, the information still comes out. They just don't sit in jail for it. Right?
Yeah. Do you have a comment about that, Professor?
Well, if the pardon's granted, they have no Fifth Amendment rights on that particular crime because there's nothing to incriminate them. That's certainly true.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a double-edged sword in that case then, isn't it?
That they couldn't hide information that they might be able to hide otherwise.
Right, the president pardons them, but then if they are called to testify, they can't invoke the Fifth. If they're found to be lying, then presumably they could still be jailed for that, right?
Right, that would be a separate crime, perjury or lying to government officers.
Okay, and David said the president. Well, let's let David ask his question, then we'll let you go. David, you're on WGN. What did you want to say?
Hi, John. How you doing?
Good. What's your thought?
Well, number one, again, as your guest said, it's remarkable we're even talking about this. But in this particular, there's a kind of civility also implied into all of our rights. And the fact that our founding fathers didn't, or that there's broad, that he has broad rights here, there's something implied about his being able to do so with a kind of collective common sense and good mental health and all of that stuff. That, you know, when there's something assumed about what we all agree upon. And, you know, this election is exceptional in that way. This person doesn't believe in those things.
Hold on. Let's let him respond to that.
That's a very insightful point. There is something called the fiduciary notion of our government that the framers sort of implicitly put in there, that government officers recognize they're in a special fiduciary relationship with the public. The problem is we have to set up our system for those cases that are the worst case scenario where the president or those in power ignore that. And that's where the Bill of Rights and the courts come into play.
You have students waiting for your expertise. Martin Reddish, professor of law at Northwestern, read his piece in the New York Times. A pardon for Arpaio would put Trump in uncharted territory. I'll call you again, Martin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, John. Good talking to you.
Likewise. He's got to run off now and teach some kids over at Northwestern. I'm just scrolling across on my phone looking at temperatures and 10-day forecasts around the country and world, for that matter. In Phoenix, the high temperature today will be 110. The next highs will be 109, 109, 108, 107. They will not get below, on the high side, 105 this week, which sounds alarming to us, but that's pretty much par for the course. In August in Phoenix, they were 10 degrees warmer than that at some point this year. And on the Arizona Central, the AZCentral.com is the website for the Arizona Republic. I think I called it the Arizona Republican earlier, the Arizona Republic newspaper. The headline is, County heat deaths continue to rise, 33 confirmed, 127 suspected. Wow.
That's
not good.
No, it isn't. And you would think, you know, because they're used to that heat, they know how to deal with it and manage it.
Maybe that's just par for the course.
Maybe.
Although they did, I think, set or tie the all-time record for warmest temperature. I think it hit like 120.
Wow.
Or
that's
something.
Hot.
Yeah. Elif's going to double check that for me. Elif, what was the highest temperature in Phoenix or in Arizona this summer? It was some insane number. By the way, just why am I on their site? Because here is the last paragraph of the editorial in the Arizona Republic over the weekend after the president pardoned their former Sheriff Joe. After Trump was elected, they wrote, many hoped that he would abandon his habit of appealing to the worst instincts of disaffected white Americans who have been left behind by economic changes that had little to do with undocumented immigration. Many hoped Trump would decide to become the president of all the people. But by pardoning Arpaio, Trump made it clear that institutional racism is not just okay with him, it is a goal. Largest newspaper, a Republican font in Arizona, said that about Arpaio's pardon. It's 241. It's really well written. You may not agree with it, but that's what they are saying about their own guy down there. It's 241 on WGN. This is John Williams. Saturdays, we talk sports with our Sam Panionovich, sort of previewing usually the big weekend games, be it a series in baseball or now one of the big games in football. And so then we like to come back on Mondays with Sam and see how things went. Of course, we also had the big fight over the weekend as well. Sam's on the phone right now. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm good. I watched the fight with our newsman, Domati Pongo, on Saturday night. It was pretty cool, although it didn't start until 10:45 at night. I always find it funny when they announce the fight card and they say 8 o'clock start time, and then the main event starts at 10:45. But it was certainly a spectacle, that's for sure.
You guys, where'd you watch it?
Watch it in Glenwood. He had a party at his sister's house. They had about 20, 25 people there, and very Mayweather-heavy crowd, to say the least.
Domati had a party and invited you?
Domati's brother-in-law and his sister had a party.
Yeah, but how did you find out about it?
Well, he had told me on Saturday morning.
Yeah, but I was here Saturday morning, too.
Well, you may have to take this up with him.
Clearly. Okay, well, enough about that. So there you were, palling around with Domati, one of my ex-friends here at WGN Radio, and his family. So was it a pretty good fight? Better than you thought it was going to be, huh?
Well, for being one of the most hyped events in the history of sports, I had high expectations. And to be honest, I thought it certainly exceeded the expectations. I didn't think it would go 7 rounds. I didn't think it would go 10 rounds. That's what it ended. Conor McGregor came out extremely strong. And that's usually how Mayweather sort of ropes you in. He likes to feel out his fighters and see how they, you know, plan their attacks and everything. And McGregor just got tired because, John, in the UFC, the maximum fight is 25 minutes. Around that 9th round, I call it spaghetti legs. McGregor was on noodle legs. He just couldn't stand up anymore. His arms got heavy, the gloves got heavy, and he just left his face completely wide open. And it was in that 9th round that Mayweather just turned it up. He put his foot on the accelerator. He was landing shot after shot after shot. And then finally in the 10th round, he had McGregor on the ropes, hit him with about 8 punches in 15 or 16 seconds, and the official called it off. Now, McGregor didn't lay on his back like he said he should have. He said he wanted to be knocked out and knocked down. But there was no way to continue that fight because Mayweather – the stamina is incredible. Even at 40 years old, he's now 50-0, which is the greatest boxing record ever. Rocky Marciano was 49-0. But the stamina you have to go 10, 11, 12 rounds with a guy like Floyd Mayweather was just too high for McGregor to match.
Will anybody put an asterisk by that 50? Because he's fighting. He got his 50th career win. Undefeated, granted, but against a guy who'd never boxed professionally before, right?
It's a good question. I don't think there will be an asterisk because Conor McGregor won't have an asterisk. He'll be 0-1, being knocked out one time, and I don't know if he'll ever box again. There are rumors. Will he return to MMA? Will he ever box again? Nobody seems to know. And, of course, Mayweather, who's retired multiple times, he retired about 5 years ago and then came back. He said after this fight, he is done for sure. We will see. The fight did gross expectedly $700 million. That's it.
Wow.
They're still tallying it up right now, and they'll have the final numbers this week. I don't think there will be an asterisk. I do know there will be buckets and buckets of cash. It's estimated that McGregor will end up around $130 million for the fight in a loss, $130 million. And Mayweather could make as much as $350 million.
Well, it was a better fight than the Pacquiao one, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Manny's shoulder was just so shot. He had nothing left. This was interesting because you had, you know, the old cat in Mayweather, like I said, 40 years old. You knew what he would bring to the table, but nobody knew what McGregor could do. Now, he boxed at the amateur level, but this is a guy that's used to kicking and kneeing and hammer punching and doing all these ridiculous moves. He had to learn how to box on the fly. I mean, he hadn't boxed professionally ever.
Did he hit?
You didn't know what you would get.
Was McGregor hitting Mayweather in the back of the head? Was he throwing some illegal punches?
They were borderline illegal. They call them rabbit punches when you hit him on the top of the head with a glove. You're not supposed to do that in boxing, and the official Robert Byrd did warn him a couple times, but nothing too illegal. Mayweather did think that he got kneed below the belt late in the fight, and ironically enough, that was when he said, all right, I've had enough. And from that point forward, he just went on a full-fledged attack. I don't think there was anything too crazy, too illegal, but he did toe the line a couple times.
Talk to me about the Bears over the weekend. What did you see? What did you like? What did you not like?
I like the competition at quarterback. Look, I've said for a couple weeks now, and it's not popular, I think Mike Glennon should start week one. I think he should start until he loses his job because Mitch Trubisky, there's a lot of highs, but there were some lows. Even in this game yesterday against Tennessee, he fumbled a snap. He almost threw an interception. He couldn't get the playoff on fourth and one. The play clock had expired.
He wasn't even close to getting that playoff on time.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even close. So, you know, for all the highlights and the 45-yard touchdown pass to Tanner Gentry was awesome, there are still some lows. And I really think until he masters this playbook, and by all accounts, he's ahead of schedule, he's progressing faster than they thought, the GM, Ryan Pace, has told us multiple times this is Mike Glennon's year. He's told you that. He's told you that multiple times. And they don't want to rush the future of the franchise into the fire with an offense that isn't built to win now. They just lost Cam Meredith, their number one receiver. He's on the shelf with a torn ACL. The offensive line a little banged up. So this team is not ready to win. And the last thing they want to do is put Mitch Trubisky, the rookie quarterback, into an inferno and have him flame out early. They just want to be as careful, as coddling as they can. And then when Glennon does lose a job, I imagine it will happen this season, then you can turn over the keys of the car.
Well, you just never know what's going to happen, too. You know, I came here from Minnesota, and they were chanting Teddy Bridgewater, Teddy, Teddy, in the stands over a year ago. He might not even play again this year. It's amazing. I'm thinking about Cam Meredith now, how in a preseason game, in Teddy's case, it was a preseason practice, how strong these guys are and also how fragile they can be at the same time.
Yeah, there was a couple of injuries yesterday. And the worst thing in football is when you have to watch the replays of a knee injury. There's nothing more depressing than watching a young budding star in Cam Meredith go through that injury, and then they bring the cart out and they drive him off the field. It's such a sad scene to witness. He wasn't the only guy that got hurt. Their long snapper, Patrick Scales, he left on crutches with a knee brace. Prince Amukamara, their cornerback, who is supposed to be in the top of the cornerback pedestal, he left with a walking boot on. Leonard Floyd, their former first-round pick, he left his injury not as serious, but there were a lot of highs yesterday for the Bears, a lot of good things, but when you lose a number one wide receiver and a long snapper and a cornerback in a preseason game, it's wishy-washy. It's tough.
Huh. Any baseball news I should be paying attention to this week?
The Cubs just dropped 3 of 4 to two last-place teams. They lost one to the Reds on Thursday, and then they dropped 2 of 3 in Philadelphia to the worst team in baseball. They are doing everything they can to keep this race tight. We talk about it all the time, how they have the most talent, and they should be winning these games against these lesser teams. But when you lose 3 out of 4 to two last-place teams, and then Joe Maddon calls out the Dodgers and says, "We want the Dodgers, bring on the Dodgers," maybe you should pump the brakes a little bit. I mean, this race continues to be way tighter than it should be because on paper, the Cubs have so much talent and so much skill and so much pedigree. And while they do well against good teams, they just can't beat bad teams. It's a roller coaster year for them. They're still in first place, and I understand that. And the Sox boys coming out right now, but this team should beat the Phillies. They should beat the Reds. It's just been an up and down year, and there's really not an answer for it. The Cubs are like their own worst enemy, really.
Yeah, that's well put. Well, has this ever happened? The team with the worst record in the playoffs wins the World Series, because we might be the team with the worst record going into the playoffs.
I'm not sure about the worst record, but there have been a couple of teams. The Tigers were a team that many thought would win the World Series in 06, but they lost to a Cardinals team that won 83 games that year in 2006. There have been plenty of wild card teams. The Marlins come to mind in 97, also in 2003. I don't know if they'd be the worst team on paper, but they may have the worst record.
Well, that's what I'm not rooting for either of those scenarios, but I'm saying that's possible. And so I guess the real question is, it is possible, right, that however badly we get into the playoffs, we might be hot at the right time, and with the talent that's on the field, we could still win the dang thing.
Just have to get in. That's right. Quick check of the standings. The Dodgers have 91 wins.
Wow.
The Nationals have 78. Yeah, the Dodgers are 91-38. It's remarkable. So Dodgers 91, Nationals 78, the two wild card teams, Arizona 73, Colorado 71, and then the Cubs, despite being a division leader, they have the least amount of wins for a playoff team right now at 69-60.
Wow. All right, Sam, anything else I need to ask you about before I let you go?
Nothing else. I should give Sox fans a little love. Lucas Giolito, their rookie starter, he made a second start with the Sox yesterday. He went 7 innings, 7 scoreless, only gave up 3 hits. That is a big part of the future. For all the talk about the Bears and the boxing match and the Cubs, you have to shine a little bit of light when a Sox prospect does something well, and it was a great start for Giolito.
Nice to hear you, Sam. I'll talk to you again on Saturday when you start picking football games for real, right?
I'm excited, man. I know you want to split that million. We'll have to sign the paperwork. Get it up.
Sam's in an official pool. Somebody put him up, 600 players or teams, players in this thing. Am I right about that? And if you win it all, if you're the best picker this year of football games, you win $1 million?
$1 million, yes. 700 players in the Vegas contest. We got sponsored by Team Odd Shark. And actually, it starts on September 9th. We'll make the picks, not this Saturday, the following Saturday. But I imagine we'll put our heads together pretty soon.
Okay, buddy. I'll talk to you later. The most shocking
image. I play a forecaster on TV.
Oh, I have sympathy for the Tom Skillings and the Hughes of the world in that Cook County's a big county. Will County's a big county. It could be pouring in one place and not at all in another. And you can't be right for everybody. So you say, hey, watch out. Some folks are getting a thunderstorm, and that's true. There is a picture of, they have this hurricane in Houston, now a tropical storm. And so they have not only like these torrential rains, they're getting tornadoes, and they're also getting lightning strikes. And there is a picture at night from one night this weekend, maybe it was last night, but it's dark, awful clouds, torrential rain, and then a bolt of lightning, it's skyscraper thick, zigzagging through the sky and illuminating the ground when it hits at night. And it's just one of those things you go, oh, like this is a picture you see in textbooks, like when the dinosaurs were walking the earth, It just looks surreal. And to think that people are going through that. I'm still sort of amazed that people don't find a way to get out of there in time. Don't you think that, and this is easy to say sitting here high and dry in Chicago, but that if you were in Houston, you would have, got a car and got out of Dodge before all of this hit? Which makes it sound like I'm being critical of those people. I don't mean to make the life of the victims worse, but I felt this way. Every time there's one of these tropical storms or hurricanes or depressions, you think, why are you people there? Why didn't you get out of the way?
One of the things that they looked at, the emergency officials, was the fact that with Rita in 2005, the mandatory evacuation forced more than 2 million people onto the expressways, the freeways, and 80 of the 103 deaths occurred people
on the
in
road.
Their cars.
Yeah.
Just 15, 20 hours trying to get out of town, running out of gas, 103-degree heat,
there was that was what they faced, and so they had this terrible dilemma.
So we were talking to Ryan. Are you guys going to talk to Ryan Burrow a little later on?
Yes, we are.
He's at one of the shelters down there, Ro. Anna DeBlantis in the studio, too. And he said that the people are being brought to this convention center in downtown Houston. Mm-hmm. Some of them in the back of dump trucks. They have dump trucks of people.
I saw a paddleboard, a kayaks. Didn't you see just any vehicle that float? I saw little kiddie pools used to transport children.
Semi-tractor trailers full of people in the back.
Yeah.
This is just get in. We'll just get you out of there.
You talk about that
every day. But I'm amazed that in Houston they don't have, I don't know what kind of vehicles they're going to use, but it's just weird that's how you get people out of there. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is... the response so far, I think, is, again, you're dealing with people who don't want to leave their homes generally, right? I mean, when you ask people mandatory evacuations, people don't want to leave anyway.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'll lock myself in because they want to be near their possessions. It's the only thing they have. They don't know where they're going to go. I mean, you do understand why people do the human instinct to do it. But then there's the people are, well, this ain't going to be nothing, you know, which is a whole other, you know, circumstance here. I am surprised, thankfully surprised, that the death and injury toll isn't as high as it is by now.
What's the last death number you guys heard? I heard
8.
Is it 8 now? I was going to say 5, but think about that. 6.5 million people.
Yeah.
8.
And you look at you look at some of those towns, ones right on the coast that got directly hit by the 120, 130 mile an hour winds, and they are just gone.
Rockport?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know this is an area.
I lived there for almost 5 years. And,
really?
And it was, and people are used to light flooding. I mean, it flooded lightly twice when I was there. My car flooded, my house flooded slightly, but enough to do damage, smaller flooding. And so people are used to dealing with this, but this one was different. And I think the city of Houston, Sylvester Turner, the mayor there, made a tough call to say, don't evacuate. We're not going to evacuate.
But you're also saying that may have been the right call, too.
According to, if you look at history as a guide, you know, they lost most of the people in Rita based on the evacuation and the fact that people ran out of gas. They were stuck in the heat. They had heat exhaustion, those kinds of issues. That's what killed them the last time.
Have a good show, guys. I'll get out of your way.